I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Alistair Cook has written his last letter from America. For the past 58 years, through moonshots and elections and assassinations, Cook's letter from America has told the story of this country through the BBC to people all around the world. Now, it wasn't always politics and hard news. Cook could be a tourist as well. Here's a brief moment from a 1978 letter from the rim of the Grand Canyon.
We mooched a mile or two along the rim and watched the sun go over and the mile-long shadows shifting across layer after layer of red and purple and yellow mesas the size of cities. And we peered into the immensity and spotted a hawk gliding down there as tiny as a housefly. But no other movement, no other sound. In the end, it becomes unbearably beautiful or preposterous or unreal, and you have to turn away and seek the company of your own kind in an enclosed space, in the restaurant, because otherwise you doubt that human beings had yet been created. Maybe the Grand Canyon, along with the exquisite, incomparable Bryce Canyon in Utah, was God's main purpose, and once they were done, it was a piddling afterthought to make Adam and Eve and the billions of scattering ants we now call the human family.
Well, Cook is now 95 years old. He recorded close to 3,000 letters from America. He's also well known to many of us for his years as host of the PBS series Masterpiece Theater. Now, Alistair Cook's letters were meant to explain what happened here to people somewhere else, but what did they say to you? Did his immigrant's perspective show you something about this country that you didn't see before? Did Alistair Cook get America right? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And this hour, we're fortunate to have with us the BBC broadcaster Nick Clark, author of Alistair Cook, The Biography. Nick's joining us from a BBC studio in London. Nick, so good of you to be with us.
Good morning.
I'm fascinated just by the man's ability to write. As I was listening to his description of the Grand Canyon there, in many ways it took me back to what were some of his best letters some years back. Do you think that's a fair comment?
What, you mean that they've got less good more recently? I'm not sure. I think that the writing is crystal clear when he's writing about nature, the scenes you described. And interestingly, Bryce Canyon was always his favorite. I don't know why. Someone had obviously sent him to the Grand Canyon, so he felt he ought to put in a good word for it. But he did have this extraordinary clarity of writing, and he said he owed it to his father and his teacher back in Blackpool in England, and they taught him to write simple, straightforward English sentences. And he went on doing that, and he then, at Cambridge, was taught by a man called Sir Arthur Quiller Couch, a famous English poet and writer and critic. And he famously said to Cook one day, after he delivered a particularly flowery undergraduate essay, he said, "Cook," he said, look at these words you've written. He said, "Cook, you must learn to murder your darlings." And he set about murdering his darlings, in other words, stripping out the adverbs and the excessive ornamentation which he'd been brought up with. And he wrote this lovely English. And I think he went on writing it. But, of course, he didn't get out much in the later years. So I suppose it was much more political and less of that very reflective, beautiful writing that he was able to do around the country.
He was in many ways a different kind of journalist, a man with kings and presidents and famous actors, not just as casual acquaintances, but as friends. And as I was reading through your own notes about the man and stories written to mark his last letter from America, it occurred to me that there probably won't be too many other Alistair Cooks.
Well, there won't for all sorts of reasons, will there? I mean, the fact that somebody can encapsulates near on 70 years of history and do it with a brain that manages to collect and gather and filter and be able to call on those people you mention, the scenes that he saw, the little backwaters of America that he found out about, and then call them to mind whenever he needed to. I mean, that's just a facility and a longevity which simply never will be repeated. But of course, you know, we've all grown up into a world now where things move on much more quickly, and no one will have the patience to allow somebody to go on doing anything, whatever it may be and however good, for so long, I don't think.
When did you last see him, Nick?
I saw him about 15 months ago in November 2002. I haven't travelled since then, only because I've acquired two small babies, so it's rather inhibited me.
Congratulations.
Otherwise, I'd have been back. Thank you. But no, his brain is absolutely clear still. There's nothing wrong with his mind, but he's old and he's tired, and I think his doctors have basically said to him what I observed that time, which is that he's finding it jolly tough to make, or he was finding it tough to make the effort to write the letter. And I think it, you know, he regarded it as a tremendous duty, but also as the years went on, as a bit of a burden, because it required much more effort than seemed likely for a 15-minute piece. The collection of information, the distilling of the information, the writing of this very conversational style, which, as you, I'm sure you know, comes out much more simply than it is to write. And all those things took a lot of effort. And I suspect that, you know, when I saw him then, I knew that it wouldn't be that much longer. I must say, I thought that he would die on the job. But he's decided, and I rather admire him for it, to say, OK, I'm just going to have a rest now and enjoy the rest of my time.
I want to listen to a little bit more of Alistair Cook. And for this, we go back to the early 60s, a time when John Glenn was an astronaut, not a politician. And for those who don't remember that time, there was a moment in 62 when Glenn was orbiting the Earth that the automatic controls of Friendship 7 weren't functioning very well, and he had to put his hands on the pilot control himself. And at that time, people were able to follow along here on this planet just exactly what was going on by listening to radio transmissions. And that's what Alistair Cook picked up on in his letter from America that week.
It took perhaps that first orbit to make the immobile millions sense that a very alert and vivacious man was in trouble somewhere between the stars. But after that, there were tales of mighty shushings in railroad stations and airports, and cab drivers shutting off their meters and halting at a curb to see it through. So that through all the catechism of cabin and oxygen pressure and respiration and the temperature of the suit and the capsule and the rest, a recognizable human being kept darting through, his boy, oh boy, delight at the beauty of the unidentified particles that swam past his window like fireflies.
Alistair Cook's letter from America from February 1962. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. It's your chance to get in on our conversation this hour about this remarkable journalist. His biographer, Nick Clark, is joining us from a BBC studio in London. Nick, let's go back a little bit to where this man came from. I saw a piece in The Economist this morning that said that Cook, in fact, reinvented himself in many ways as an American. Why would they make that claim?
Well, I think they probably stole it from me, because I think it's in the book somewhere. I had him reinventing himself several times, and I think he did, really. I think he was born in very humble conditions in a small corner of Manchester called Salford, on the banks of a river, a canal. It was a pretty grubby, poor area. And his father was an iron fitter. His mother took out washing sometimes. And then for her health, they moved to Blackpool, about 50 miles away on the coast, on the northwest of England. And she ran a guest house, and actually among her first customers, this was about 1917, were American soldiers on their way to the front. So that was his first exposure to Americans, and by God, he really loved them. He just thought they were fantastic. But anyway, there he was, this boy from this quite humble background, who ended up, through good schoolmastering and fathering, at Cambridge. And from being a provincial boy, he turned himself into a toff in next to no time. I mean, extraordinarily quickly he adjusted and took on the colour of the place. And then he found himself in America, and I think he was probably more American than most Americans before you could turn round. And he became someone who felt totally at home there, sounded as if he felt totally at home there, and was taken at face value for what he had become. And that's what kept on happening. He turned into a television star on your Omnibus series in the 50s. Now, he'd never really done television, but suddenly there he was, a ready-to-wear, beautifully fitted-out, elegant television star, as if he'd always been one. Whatever he wanted to turn his hand to, that's what he became. It took hard work, but he had this extraordinary facility to adapt to his surroundings.
But after he had lived in the United States for 20, 30, 40 years, how was he regarded in Britain? Was he still seen as a local boy sending missives back home, or did people sort of think he'd gone native?
Really interesting question. I think most British people regarded him still as having enough contact with Britain, although actually he had practically none, to be regarded as an honorary British person. Even though he was manifestly only interested in what was happening in America, we sort of never quite lost him. And I spoke to his wife often about, his wife used to tease him about this, because As I said to you, I think he became very American quite quickly. And probably if you listened to him in the 40s and 50s, you'd have heard an American speaking. As time went on and he got older, the accent became more East Coast, more Boston, I think more English. And he gradually reverted to type. And he's never really lost that some of those essential English qualities. So I don't know. You'd have to judge by listening to him. Interestingly, that clip you played from Glenn, your listeners may be wondering about it. It did sound quite elderly for the 1960s, and it was, in fact, I'm sure, re-recorded. The BBC, the BBC lost or let go a tremendous number of Letters from America, which is a great, great shame. And when it came time to try and put together some collections of his work from the archive, they found there were very few extant, and not enough, really. And so what they decided to do was to re-record them all so you wouldn't have a great unevenness of quality. So if people listen to that tape, that I'm pretty sure that was recorded when he was in his 80s.
Oh, interesting. 1-800-423-8255. Let's take a call from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Stephen's joining us. Stephen, thanks for calling.
Yeah, hello.
Are you a fan of Alistair Cook, Stephen?
Well, yes, I am. My family just moved back to the States from having lived in the United Kingdom for the past 18 years. And it was very much, before the Internet came on, it was very much the only connection that we really had on a regular basis to what was happening.
So you would listen weekly to the Letter from America?
Yes. We listened every Sunday morning at 10 o'clock. And actually, my wife is sort of missing it now because we can't get it here.
I understand that the BBC, Nick, plans on replaying some of the letters so people like Stephen, who are still in the UK, won't suffer from a sudden end of the Letters
from
America.
That's right. I think they are. They're planning to do that over a few weeks. I was very interested in what Stephen said because I'd be interested to hear what he thought about this problem that Alistair thought he had. I mean, one of the reasons why the letter wasn't widely played in the United States was because he felt it would be easier to give this what he felt was an honest appraisal of what was happening and what lay behind the headlines if he wasn't broadcasting to Americans. So I'm fascinated to know. I mean, did it feel to you like an honest and proper look, Stephen, about what was happening
in
your own country?
Yeah, very much so. I always felt that the information that he was providing and the opinions he was providing and the emotion that he gave were an honest reflection of a British person living in America.
And you found his analysis was fair and balanced.
In general, I thought it was right on, yeah.
Stephen, I want to thank you for your call. Nice to have you with us on the program. A reminder to our listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. Nick Clark wrote the biography of Alistair Cook. He is my guest this hour. We will be talking when we come back after the break with Tony Grant, who has worked on Letter from America for the past 10 years as a producer with the BBC. We'll get a chance to listen to a little bit more of Alistair Cook himself as we, on this hour, mark the last Letter from America. 1-800-423-8255. That's the number to join us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection from NPR. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. You can call that number to join our conversation about Alistair Cook. His last Letter from America has been on the air. We're joined now on the phone from London by Tony Grant, who for the past 10 years has worked on Letter from America. Tony, good of you to take a few minutes out of your day to be with us. I gather you're on deadline, am I right?
Yes, that's right, Dick. We're, in fact, tidying up the tonight's Letter from America, which will go out in Britain in the next few hours' time. So that's what we're doing now. It's been a bit of a sad week for us, as you can imagine.
It's a rebroadcast, this letter, if I understand correctly, taking us back to one that either you or he was quite fond of.
That's absolutely right. This is an edition which was first broadcast in December 2001. Funnily enough, it has particular resonance for me because the only time I've ever been over to talk to Alistair in New York was in December 2001, and I sat in on this recording by chance, and I thought at the time, is this one particularly magnificent just because I'm kind of hearing it live, or is it a fantastic one anyway? And then we find that this was the one that Alistair Cook selected to play tonight, so it should be a good evening for us.
That is also including his reflections on 9/11, something that had quite an impact on him.
Well, it certainly did, and who can be surprised at that, living and working in the shadow of the Twin Towers? But in fact, this is not probably the one that most people associate with that horrific day, because he, of course, broadcast a piece a few days later, his usual weekend letter. So this one was some months afterwards, and it did touch on the disaster, but more it talked about the church, which is close to the site there, how even in December 2001, its organ pipe were still clogged by ash, but nevertheless they managed to clear enough space to put on a magnificent performance of Handel's Messiah just before the New York Christmas.
A quick peek behind the curtain before I let you go, Tony. Was he an easy man to work with? Was he a cranky guy to work with? What was it?
Well, on that particular occasion when I met him in New York, he was charm itself. He had a million anecdotes about Robert Benchley and Thurber and Dorothy Parker, and you couldn't stop him. He was great company, and he was full of laughs. But on the other couple of other occasions, I met him in London when he came over just occasionally and recorded the talk at Broadcasting House here. He didn't have a very good high opinion of London cab drivers. I remember him complaining bitterly that they couldn't even find the way to Broadcasting House from Mayfair a mile or two away. So, well, like everyone else, you can have a harsh word occasionally about cabbies, but he was very nice when I met him.
For the past 10 years, Tony Grant has been a producer working on Alistair Cook's Letter from America. He joined us on the phone from London. Tony, thanks so much for your time.
That's great, Dick. Cheers.
1-800-423-8255. We actually have on the line with us now from Boston, Rebecca Eaton, who was a producer of Masterpiece Theater and worked with him for how long, Rebecca? How long here?
I'm just trying to remember, from about 1985 to when he retired about 10 years later. It was about 10 years.
And it's funny, you know, when we talk around the office here about the number of people in the Boston station here who know him better from Masterpiece Theater than know him from Letter from America.
Yes, but, you know, he turned down the job of Masterpiece Theater in the beginning. That's a dirty little secret that not many people know. It was when Masterpiece started in 1971, he was offered the job, and he said, no, I don't want to do that. I'm a journalist, and I do television journalism. And it was actually his daughter, Susie, who took him out behind the woodshed and said, Dad, this is the perfect job for you. You've got to do this. And he said, okay, I'll do it. I'll do it for a year. And the first program we did was called The First Churchills, about the Churchill family in England. And he was convinced the show was so terrible, there wouldn't be a second season. So 22 years later, he retired from Masterpiece Theater.
Now, Rebecca, don't go anywhere, because I want to bring Nick Clark, Alistair's biographer, back into the conversation. Nick, this man juggled so many jobs and so many different careers.
Well, it's nice to hear from you, Rebecca. Yes, he certainly did. I mean, the story is a lovely one of Susie persuading him to do the job. But, of course, one of the reasons he wasn't particularly keen was he was already doing three jobs at that particular moment. He was in the throes of finishing the television series America, which made such a huge impression on both sides of the Atlantic. He was still, of course, doing Letter from America. And The Guardian thought he was still working for them, although, to be perfectly frank, he'd more or less stopped writing. He kept receiving these retainers, and there were a lot of angry letters from the Guardian offices in London saying, excuse me, what are we getting for our money? So it was extraordinary. Everything he did for ages. You know, he worked for The Guardian for 25 years, Rebecca says. He did Masterpiece Theatre for much the same time, 58 years, Letter from America. It was just extraordinary how once, as I said before, once he got into a job, he was a sticker.
And Rebecca, was he aware of the fact that here in the United States, he was also shaping Americans' ideas of what it was like to be a British writer, presenter, storyteller?
Yes, although I think he would be the first to say he always considered his primary job his letter from America. That was his real job. Masterpiece Theater was the night job. The day job was Letter from America. He felt that was his most important contribution, and doing Masterpiece Theater was just fun. oddly, I mean, he was an American citizen by the time he did Masterpiece Theater, and people thought of him as the quintessential Englishman. And he knew that he had information for them that nobody else could give, so he did it from that way. But people assumed he lived in London. They thought he was an aristocrat, if not, as Nick said, and at least an upperclassman, which he wasn't at all. He never pretended to be particularly, but that was the assumption. I think Americans had a fairly limited view of what you could be as an Englishman, either Cockney or royalty. But I was just going to say one other thing that Nick will know well about Alistair. He could have been a number of other things that those of us who know him well know. He could have been a doctor, fascinated by medicine. He could have been an actor, which is why I think he was as good as he was at both Masterpiece Theater and The Letter, because he's an actor. He knew how to communicate with an audience. He could have been a musician. He's a jazz pianist. Or, worst come to worst, he could have been a cartoonist. He has a fantastic eye and a wonderful hand at doing cartoons, particularly of himself, by the way.
That's absolutely true. And I've managed to steal some of the cartoons for my book. I headed each section with them because I was so struck by them. And the acting career nearly took off in the most dramatic way because he managed to work his way as a young man into Charlie Chaplin's studio in Los Angeles. And he told Chaplin that he'd got this commission from an English paper to write an article about Hollywood stars. And he told Chaplin that he'd got the commission and the paper that he'd got Chaplin. Neither was true, but he managed to get the story and Chaplin took to him. He thought he was great. He had him around as an assistant. He wanted him to be an assistant director on Modern Times. He turned that down. And then he said, well, I'll make you into one of the finest young romantic leads that Hollywood's ever seen. And he turned that down too. So Rebecca's absolutely right.
One of the things that struck me listening back to some of his older stories, though, is his description of his time with the stars. Here he is in a restaurant with Groucho Marx.
The most memorable example I can think of this language game happened when we were lunching with him at the most luxurious of Jewish country clubs in Los Angeles. When the menu was passed around, I raised an eyebrow at what even then were outrageous prices. Fear not, my friend, said Groucho. It's only money. The initiation fee at this club is $10,000, and for that you don't even get a dill pickle. When the main course was over, and the waiter came to take the dessert order, he stumbled several times over who was having what, and finally he said, four eclairs and two coffees, and Groucho whipped in with, four eclairs and two coffees ago, our forefathers brought forth on this continent a nation dedicated to the proposition, skip the dedication and bring the dessert.
From December 1977. You ever heard that one before, Rebecca?
No,
and nor have I. More to my chagrin. I've got a couple of Groucho Marx stories. He tried to get Groucho on Omnibus in the 1950s. I've got the letter that Groucho sent him back here. It says, to Alistair Cook, I was a little disappointed on receiving your rather lengthy letter to find no mention of money. I am, of course, an artist with my head in the clouds. I was very happy to be invited to appear gratis or thereabouts on Meet the Press, The Last Word, etc. But my business manager, Mr. Gummo Marx, has a passion for money that is virtually a sickness. I'm constantly being embarrassed by it. Still, he is my brother, and rather than upset him, I have to bow to his wishes.
He was... Nick and I can't get a word in edgewise between each other. We have so many stories to tell. But Alistair is a fabulous mimic, and he does Franklin Roosevelt better than anyone, but his best, Nick, you probably would agree, is
absolutely
Winston Churchill, who is his idol. He loves Winston Churchill, and he does a drop-dead Winston Churchill.
And Winston Churchill listened to those letters from America. They mattered to him, too, did they not, Nick?
They did, and indeed many prime ministers have said the same. I mean, there was a sort of special cachet, I think, about listening to Alistair Cook. He did tell them something which they needed to know, not exactly the stuff they were getting through the embassy. But yes, Churchill certainly listened, and he has treasures a note from Churchill's wife after Churchill's death expressing exactly that view. I haven't got the words in front of me, but she wrote to him saying, look, Alistair meant a lot to you, and that meant a lot to him. He's got a bust of Churchill in his study, and as you say, that was, as Rebecca pointed out, one of the reasons he loathed that Churchill series so much is that he didn't think the great man's ancestors should be so traduced on television as they were.
And the royal family listened to him as well. On one occasion, there was a reception for Alistair, and Princess Anne was there. And she was very shy to meet him because she idolized him so, and said that she and Charles, in the car on the way to church on Sunday mornings, Alistair would be on the radio in the car.
They'd probably have to take an extra couple of turns just to make sure they got the entire letter. 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Durham, North Carolina now, and Matt's joining us on the phone. Matt, thanks for calling.
You're welcome, Dick. Just thought I'd share a little bit of what Alistair means to me from when I first heard him. I'm a pretty young guy, and I didn't get to hear him until the very end of his career. But I was traveling in Kenya shortly after the 9/11 attacks when I first heard him. And to hear him over there, I had to stay up late at night about 3 in the morning. And it was just a time of incredible anxiety, of course, for everyone. There's a lot of anti-American sentiment growing in the third world, and a lot of distance growing between Europe and America, as Iraq became to be hotly debated. And that's when that was the environment when I first heard him. And I'll never forget it, because he felt like such a sympathetic ambassador for America, which is just incredible to hear at that time of anxiety. And even beyond the particular conflict of Iraq or Afghanistan, it was incredible to me to have such a weathered guide through the conflicts of the past to take me through. It just made me feel like the values that America tries to uphold really were broader than just that particular conflict. You know, he would take us back through the debates with Chamberlain and Hitler. With the perspective no one else could give you.
Matt, I like the word that you used, ambassador, because I think, Nick Clark, that even if we go back to his early days, there was a certain quality of Alistair Cook feeling like he did need to somehow explain America to Britain, did he not?
It was an absolute passion, and as Rebecca's pointed out, this is the thing that mattered more than him, to him than anything. He started trying to sell the BBC these letters in the mid-1930s, as soon as he arrived back in America in 1937. A program which none of us will remember directly, I suspect, is called Mainly About Manhattan, that appeared in 1938. 15-minute talks about America and American life, and then a few in the war called American Commentary. He finally got his letter from America in 1946. And his aim was, exactly as you say, it was to say to people in Britain, however mad and inexplicable American life might seem to you, to us in Britain, there was a logic behind it. It was sensible. These were real, ordinary people living their lives just like you. You might resent Americans for lording it over us after winning the war. You might resent their superpower status. You might not understand what happened in their race riots or the assassination of their presidents. But here is a country, like your country, full of the same people with the same passions, the same anxieties, and if you understand that better, then you will not be so alarmed by the way the headlines sell America to you.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. And Rebecca, I think what I find so striking about the man's storytelling skills and is that he was able to accomplish exactly what Nick has described, but he never, ever sounded or sounds to me like he was banging a drum or boosting anything.
Oh, never. Here's how he used to do his introductions to Masterpiece Theater, which is, I think, something else people don't know. They assumed he lived in London. He lives in New York. He lives in Fifth Avenue in the same apartment he's lived in for 50 years or so. And he would get on the shuttle and fly up to Boston. We would send him the tapes ahead of time. In the old days, he would have to come up here and look at them and then write his introductions. We would send him the tapes. He would screen them. He would write his talk in his old manual typewriter, his introduction. He would come up here. We would have a day or two in the studio. And right before we would tape it, we would have the studio be absolutely quiet. He would go in a corner, and he would memorize his introductions. This is before teleprompters. And they could be up to 10, 12 minutes long. And then he would deliver them to camera with no cards, no notes, completely from memory. And then that would be episode one. Then we would take a break. He would go back in the corner and memorize episode two.
Wow.
And as you remember from Jewel and the Crown, I, Claudius, there were 12, 13 episodes with introductions and extras. And we would do this over a period of a couple of days. He would do it, memorize them one right after the other. When he would do, usually in one take, he would erase them from his mind somehow, so he had room to put the next one in. And as he said in his delivery, because he's so good at this, it's the same quality that's in his talk, and people would say, how do you do it? You know, how do you have this connection with your audience? And he said, I visualize one person. I imagine I am just speaking to one person, which I think gives it that unique conversational storytelling tone. besides which he's a fabulous writer, and he knows how to bury the lead, as you say, in journalism. And he starts out, you're not sure where he's going with it, and then all of a sudden, there's where it is. So you can't, as we say, take your ears off him in radio, take your eyes off him in TV.
Rebecca, I know you're a personal friend. When next you speak with him, would you give him our regards?
I certainly will, and I'll also give him a tape of this show, which I'm sure he will love to hear.
Well, it's very sweet of you to call. Thanks so much.
Great. Bye, Nick.
And let's go next to, where are we off to? Providence, Rhode Island. Dr. G.E. Erickson is on the line. Dr. Erickson, thank you for calling.
Well, what a treat to hear from Alistair. I'm an 85-year-older and have been listening to him from almost the beginning. I've taped hundreds of these letters.
Now, you were listening on this side of the ocean, were you?
That's right. But wherever I traveled with my shortwave radio, I could pick him up. But there was a celebration at the time of what could it be the 1,000th broadcast, and listeners phoned in, and I phoned in to confess to Mr. Cook that I had been snooping, that he didn't aim those letters to Americans, and that was explained this morning also. We were getting it by shortwave, and I think there were four different hours, four different frequencies, and that was the days in which the signal was being bounced off the ionosphere. And listening to some of those old tapes, it's full of fading and static and reminds us of what modern technology has done for us.
Did he get it right, Dr. Erickson? Did Alistair Cook get it right in telling the story of America?
Oh, my word, he did indeed. It was a liberal education to follow him week to week. I could not imagine. He described somewhat about how he would write up some of these out on, was it Montauk Point or Orient Point, where he had his summer place, and then in his apartment overlooking Central Park. And he'd made you feel that you were with him on both of those places, and you felt this is Mr. Cultivated British American.
Dr. Erickson, thank you so much for your call. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. What did Alistair Cook say to you? How well did he get his letter from America? Was the snapshot in proper focus? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio, and we are marking on this program The Last Letter from America by Alistair Cook. We have with us from the BBC in London, Nick Clark. He is the author of a book called Alistair Cook, The Biography. He's also a presenter for BBC Radio 4's newscast World at One. Nick, I'm curious to know if you ever had a chance to speak to him about one broadcast of Cook's, which I'll never, ever get out of my head, and that is his own personal eyewitness account of the assassination of Senator Robert Kennedy.
I have spoken to him about it, and indeed the original pieces of paper on which he wrote it are in the Boston University Library Museum, where he's placed all his papers over time, and I think more will arrive there in due course. It was an extraordinary day, and he was in Los Angeles visiting a friend. He wasn't actually working, and he went down. They decided late in the evening to go down to the Ambassador's Hotel to just simply to see Bobby Kennedy receive the accolades of the crowd there. He was about to get the California nomination. And then the assassination took place. The body was brought through into the kitchen where Cook was waiting to meet Kennedy, and he saw the body laid out in front of him. And I think he did something which he never did at any other time in his life. He froze. He lost his reportorial instincts just for an hour or two. He went back to the house where he was staying. The guardian rang him up, and he then sat down in the middle of the night and on these scraps of paper wrote his first reflections on the events. And it is the most extraordinary piece of writing. And then 2 days later, he then had to do a letter from America. We've heard a lot about its conversational style and its circuitous routes and so on. Here was this event which had happened in front of his eyes, and I think it's the most stunning broadcast. And I think it was probably in many ways an easy one for him to write, because he had this facility once he had the idea in his mind the words just took off. But to hear them and to read them was a very wonderful thing.
There was suddenly a banging repetition of a sound that I don't know how to describe. Not at all like shots, like somebody dropping a rack of trays. Half a dozen of us were startled enough to charge through the door. And it had just happened. It was a narrow lane he had to come through, for there were two long steam tables, and somebody had stacked up against them those trellis fences with artificial leaves stuck on them that they used to fence the dance band off from the floor. The only light was the blue light of three fluorescent tubes slotted in the ceiling. But it was a howling jungle of cries and obscenities and flying limbs, and two enormous men, Roosevelt Greer, the football player, and Rafer Johnson, I guess, the Olympic champion, piling onto a pair of blue jeans. There was a head on the floor, streaming blood, and somebody put a Kennedy boater under it, and the blood trickled down like chocolate sauce on an ice cake. There were flashlights by now, and the button eyes of Ethel Kennedy turned to cinders. She was slapping a young man, and he was saying, "Listen, lady, I'm hurt too." And down on the greasy floor was a huddle of clothes, and staring out of it, the face of Bobby Kennedy.
That's Alistair Cook writing some 5 days after the assassination of Senator Robert Kennedy, one of the events of this country that he witnessed and incorporated into his long-running radio series, Letter from America. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We're going to Cambridge, Massachusetts now, and Jahan is with us. Jahan, do you remember that one?
I don't remember that one. My memories go back much earlier. You'll have to forgive me. I'm close to tears. I was born in 1938, so I suppose by the time I was really paying attention to things, he was just beginning the Letters from America. And I lived in deepest country, only child, 10 minutes walk to the road with the bus stop. And the BBC was tremendously important to my family and to me. One of the best things about the BBC was that it was so open to all sorts of aspects of America. I remember hearing Orson Welles reading Leaves of Grass, which made an immense impression. Also, folk songs and folk music, but above all, every week, Alistair Cook. It wasn't so much the information, it was the manner. He was obviously tremendously affectionate, but not in the least a booster. He had that edge of detachment. I didn't know, of course, that he was English. I didn't know he was, like me, from the industrial north. But he had the little bit of detachment that made the affection really tell and really let one feel that America and England were in the same world. I'm deeply, deeply grateful to him.
And I'm grateful to you for your call. I want to turn to Nick on this role that he had in linking these two countries. We've spoken about it in political terms, the way that he influenced leaders or was friends with them. But, gosh, when you think about his role as an explainer, going, you know, crossing the Atlantic, it's quite remarkable to reflect back on the length of time that he carried that weight, that responsibility.
It was a very touching contribution you just heard from Massachusetts, and it struck a chord with me because in those early days, particularly when your listener may remember most vividly some of those talks, I suppose we have to recall that most people in this country didn't know very much about the United States at all. And Cook's great mission was conceived in the 30s when everyone's impression in this country was taken from Hollywood through Hollywood's prism and filter. Mm. And Hollywood portrayed Americans as gangsters or cowboys or people who took part in chases, or one or two, I suppose, city slickers in New York would have appeared in films, and that was more or less that. And he felt that it was possible to convey to people, just by telling the stories of his own life and the lives of the people he met and the places he went, a different story, as I've tried to explain. And I think in the 40s and right up into the 50s in this country, much later than in yours, there was very little access to information about America that wasn't political or wasn't through the movies. Now, obviously, in the 60s and onwards, the media explosion meant that people had a much broader base from which to collect their information. And now, of course, one can't stop wherever one looks. But Alistair kept going. And why was it still interesting when he wasn't telling you things which you couldn't find out anywhere else? It was because, I think, of this ability to make connections, just as your listener pointed out, one of your early listeners pointed out, between the past and the present, to make September the 11th, to put it in that context that came from other events in American history. He was the man who could do that because he'd been there, he'd seen it, and he'd done it. And so he adopted a new role, really, from the one he'd originally taken upon himself.
Our next call comes from Old Hickory, Tennessee, and Bernie's joining us on the line. Bernie, thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. This is so emotional that I just want to remind your listeners, Alistair Cook is still alive.
Very, very good point.
Thank you for that, Bernie. We're just missing the letter.
Yes. But I am so grateful for this opportunity, and I am in tears, to say thank you to him for all the years that he taught me by his writing, his details, his color, and his great heart, what it means to be an American. I'm not old enough to have seen Omnibus, although I really wish that I was, and I've been trying to find that program on video or DVD. I did grow up watching Alistair Cook's America, and I know that as a writer, which is what I do, that his voice, I hope, was absorbed into my soul or my consciousness. And it's only been in the last few months, and I'm so grateful to WPLN, our local station, now has an AM side so I can listen to the BBC. Every weekend, I go to sleep listening to Alistair Cook, and I never know exactly when it's coming on, but I listen to him and his letter to America, and it feels like a grandfather telling me a bedtime story.
6:45 on a Sunday morning is when I used to listen to it lying in bed as a young guy in Canada, and it was the way to wake up on that day. You know, it had that same effect, I think, on me, Bernie, that you're describing, is that it was a part of the week. It was an easy way to mark that week, and a moment almost of sort of reflection when someone with the skill to tell a story could put that week in some kind of context.
Right. I'm so grateful, and so grateful that we can give him this tribute while he's very much alive. And every time I heard him, I had this mental image, and I'm glad to hear that I wasn't so far off, of him being in a wonderful old New York apartment on his manual typewriter, typing these things out and then reading them into his microphone there in his wonderful apartment. And it sounds like I'm not too far off from what one of your guests said, but he told us, and I'm so grateful too that I caught the program today, and my heart did catch in my throat when I heard you say Alistair Cook has read his last letter to America. I almost drove off the side of the road.
No, he's very much with us, 95 years old, but still with us. And Bernie, I want to thank you for your call. A reminder to our listeners: you are listening to The Connection from NPR. Nick, I'm interested just in your reaction to the type of sort of strongly held emotion that you hear from the people who felt that Cook was a part of their life here, even though they were hearing him in a sort of snooping way, like we heard earlier in the program.
I'm very touched and very moved by it. I've always sort of assumed that the Letter from America was really only available to those on the East Coast and then the West Coast, and for those like your older listener earlier who made such a huge effort by shortwave radio. I'm very, very touched. And you can assure your last listener, if Bernie's still listening, the apartment is exactly as she describes it. It overlooks Central Park, the reservoir. It's 15 stories up. It is more or less laid out the way that he and his wife designed it back in the mid-1940s. And he has a beautiful book-lined study. It's, mind you, I shouldn't say book-lined. He always joked about all interviewers calling it a book blind study, and he got so fed up with this, he once covered all the bookshelves with pictures of nudes when an interviewer came around, hoping against hope that it would be described as a nude lined study. It didn't happen, and the bookshelves are all laid out with the Pacific Northwest in the top left hand corner and Florida down the bottom right, just in case he needed to refer to it. Obviously his memory didn't require that very often. It's a great, great, great spot.
Tell me, Nick, as a presenter for BBC Today, whether or not the influence of Alistair Cook's writing for talking is something that is still with the BBC, something that still marks you and your colleagues.
I think that's a very interesting point, and I don't think we'll be able to tell for a while. We get used to it, you know, it's just been there all the time. I've been brought up with it. I've been working for Radio 4 for 15 years, maybe, and I'd listened to the BBC for much longer than that. And it's always been there. Now, was I influenced by it? I don't know. I certainly listen to it every week, and I try to write in a clear way. Whether those two things are connected, we shall have to wait and see. But the overall style of that 15-minute talk is something which dates back to the 20s and 30s. Now, will it last? Will it survive his giving up the letter? I don't know. I wonder. I don't know the BBC's decided yet exactly what to do about that slot, whether they want to try and keep it going. We have a tradition, as you do on NPR, of spoken radio, nicely written pieces, descriptive pieces, talk sometimes, not only interviews and drama and the rest of it. And I think that will continue. Whether that particular type of writing survives, I have my doubts.
Now tell me something. Alistair Cook, the biography, what was his reaction to your book?
Well, it's a very interesting question. I mean, obviously, he didn't want to do it in the first place. And I persuaded him by finding some, I think, by finding some old friends of his from school in Blackpool and then some of his Cambridge colleagues and putting them back in touch with each other. And he eventually agreed, and he was extremely helpful. I couldn't have done it without him. I needed his help not just to talk to him, which I did for hours and hours and hours, which is a huge privilege, as you can imagine, but also because I needed access to libraries and so on, and I needed his permission to do that. But having finished the work, I delivered it to him in a finish. He didn't want to look at it. I finished it, the book. It was printed and published. I handed it to him and waited, and nothing happened. And that was 5 years ago. And my information is that he's never read it. Now, is this true? I don't know. I just have a sneaking feeling that because I've put things in the book which are, I hope it's a fair book, and his friends like the book, and his wife liked the book, but there are things in it that are slightly at odds with some of the ways which he's always told his stories. And I just have a feeling that if he'd read it, he might have rung me up quite quickly and said, "Nick, what are you talking about? What do you mean it was 1933? Of course it wasn't. It was 1934. It never happened. So maybe he never has read it. That's quite some restraint, isn't it?
Well, maybe he's the only one who gets to reinvent himself. Nick, I want to thank you so much for being on the program with us today.
Dick, I've really enjoyed myself. It's been great talking about him. As I say, I've been very moved by many of the calls that have come in from your listeners.
Yeah, me too. I agree with that. Nick Clark is Alistair Cook's biographer. The name of the book is Alistair Cook, The Biography. Earlier in the program, we talked with Tony Grant, producer for Letter from America. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.